You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, we focus our attentions on Africa with two experts on the continent, Martin Plout of the Institute for Commonwealth Studies and the editor of Think Africa Press, James Schneider, will join us to discuss the challenges of delivering military support and humanitarian relief and the complexities of South African politics. Then in part two, we change tack and head to Sweden, where Stockholm's Furniture and Lighting Fair began today. We'll hear from the curator of one of its key exhibitions.
There's no overall theme or concept to the show. I really acted more as someone who selected the participants and looking at their work and seeing how they would fit side by side.
All that, plus our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho reports on a political ruckus in Italy, and we select some new tracks from New York music label Luaka Bop in today's review. Here's a flavour. All that and a bit more besides ahead on today's edition of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty ahead then in the next hour here on Midori House. Before we get started, let's catch up with the latest world news. Here's Paul Osborne.
The Taliban in Pakistan has criticised the country's government, saying it's not serious about peace talks. Preliminary negotiations were cancelled earlier, with officials saying they wanted further clarification on exactly who they'd be meeting. The talks were meant to set a roadmap for more substantive negotiations. Meanwhile, Afghanistan officials have confirmed the President, Hamid Karzai, has held secret talks with the Taliban in the past 2 months. Britain says its military did offer advice to India before an attack on a Sikh temple 30 years ago in which up to 3,000 people died. A review was ordered after the claims first emerged last month of possible British links to the Amritsar massacre in 1984. It was meant to target Sikh extremists, but civilians and pilgrims were caught in the crossfire. Britain's foreign secretary says the advice had only a limited impact on what he called an utter tragedy. Syed Akbaruddin speaks for India's foreign ministry.
The UK government has kept us informed about the matter. They have also recently shared with us the outcome of their inquiry on the subject. We have noted the outcome of the inquiry as well as the statement on the matter.
A former Rwandan intelligence chief has gone on trial in Paris, accused of complicity in the genocide in the country 20 years ago. It's alleged Pascal Simbikangwa helped to arm ethnic Hutu militias and encourage them to kill Tutsis. It's thought around 800,000 people died in the fighting in Rwanda. Simbikangwa, who is paraplegic, was arrested 6 years ago. He denies all the charges. Opposition MPs have told Ukraine's parliament there must be changes to the country's constitution. They want the power of the president reduced as pressure continues on Viktor Yanukovych to respond to weeks of anti-government demonstrations. One opposition leader has accused the president of dragging his feet in responding to public demands for reform. Thailand's main opposition party has launched a legal challenge to try to annul the results of Sunday's election. The Democrat Party claims the ballot violated the constitution, as voting didn't take place in 9 provinces. The government says opposition blockades of polling stations caused the problems. Richard Lloyd Parry, who's the Asia editor of The Times, says anti-government protesters are calm, but are not expected to give up.
It's a bit more relaxed. They've consolidated some of the encampments, closed a couple of down, brought people in. And the protesters are, I think, taking a bit of a breather, but that certainly isn't to say that they've given up, and there's no doubt that there will be more tumult in the days and weeks ahead.
The chief US negotiator on Iran's nuclear program has admitted the interim deal struck with Tehran last year was not perfect. But Wendy Sherman says it's allowed world powers more time to agree a longer-term deal to restrict Iran's nuclear activities. Further talks are due to take place later this month. Iran has said it wants all sanctions lifted in return for a permanent agreement. Sherman says the negotiations won't be easy.
We are not blind, however, to the more than 30 years of difficult history between the United States and Iran, or Iran's past actions and past behavior, as well as its current behavior. But it is crucial that we give diplomacy a chance to succeed.
Microsoft has named its next chief executive. Satya Nadella will take over from Steve Ballmer as the firm's third chief executive. Microsoft's founder, Bill Gates, is stepping down as chairman, but he will take up a new role as a technology advisor. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Just ticking towards 6 minutes past the hour here in London. Paul will return, of course, later with some world news headlines for you. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we'll return right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in New York City. Well, joining me now on the programme with their take on the news here in the studio, I'm delighted to welcome Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and a former foreign correspondent, and James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. Gentlemen, welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us, as always.
Thank you.
On Midori House, now, as you may imagine from my guest's area of expertise, we're focusing today on the continent of Africa. We'll start by exploring the challenging facing three neighbouring countries in Central Africa and the ability of military and humanitarian organisations to provide effective relief and security. We're talking today about the Central African Republic, Sudan and Rwanda. We'll look at Sudan and the lessons that should have been learnt from Rwanda two decades ago in a moment. We'll start in the Central African Republic. Divided along political and religious lines, the security of the capital, Bangui, is upheld by a large number of French troops and an African Union force. Outside the capital, though, most recently the town of Bodo, there have been reports of mass killings where international relief and military efforts just seem unable to reach. James, if I'll start with you, how much of a problem is it, do you think, when we have countries like this Central African Republic, which we know are racked with so much instability, and there's simply an inability of Western aid and other organisations to actually deliver security, to deliver help to the people who need it most? This is a very grave problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I think within Central African Republic, there's sort of two big problems. One is just getting the amount of aid pledged that's required. So because the Central African Republic is a less known about country, it has fewer kind of institutional supporters around the world. The funding that has been required for it has been much less. If you compare it to South Sudan, which is not to diminish the crisis that is there, but the funding for South Sudan, which is also falling short, it's significantly less. And then, yeah, there've been large difficulties for logistically getting aid in. There was a problem a couple of weeks ago for truck drivers from Cameroon who are trying to drive in aid, and they just wouldn't go in because of fears of violence. So these things have to be looked at as they interlock. The security situation and the humanitarian situation are incredibly linked.
Martin, it is difficult, isn't it, these kind of challenges? They're structural challenges, really, on such a large scale. Is enough done to address them on that structural level, do you think?
Well, the difficulty is really, in the end, comes down to Africa's ability to deal with its own crises. I mean, there was the slogan, African solutions to African problems. And the difficulty is that for 10 years now, the African Union has been attempting to get going a standby brigade, which should be able to go in for exactly this kind of crisis, because that's the difference between the OAU and the African Union, which the OAU was its predecessor, was it was supposed to intervene in these kind of crises, head them off, stop them with their standby brigade. The difficulty is that they've never materialized.
So but is that a question of resources? Is it a question of a lack of collective will? Why do you think that's been so difficult to get off the ground?
Look, resources are a problem. But when you think that of the billions that have been squandered by African leaders, then you can't believe its resources. I mean, places like Equatorial Guinea or Angola could fund anything they wanted. They have plenty of money. That's not an issue. The question is politics. And at the heart of this is the problem that, you know, the two major countries, South Africa and Nigeria, are both now led by weak presidents. Neither of them have the political will or ability to engage in the way that Obasanjo and Mbeki did way back, because they had that kind of clout and determination to take on those issues, and it just doesn't exist.
We'll talk a little more about the sort of problems facing domestic South African politics a little later. I just wonder, James, on this point, though, do you think it's complicated further when you have, say, you know, France, former colonial powers involved? Does that make it even more difficult, or should that not distract from these fundamental problems, which are, as Martin's identified there?
I think the fact that France is involved and in many ways has to be involved in the Central African Republic should focus the mind much more on the need for rapid reaction force, the need for an African security architecture that can deal with some of these issues. But just to slightly place it in context, I think Martin's right. It is political failings. But also in the EU, we're meant to have a European rapid reaction task force, which doesn't exist either, again, for political reasons. It's these are African failings, and there are particularities in these African failings, but also it is a difficult political process anywhere in the world to come up with this sort of security architecture, which is really needed.
Absolutely. Well, in the absence of that, then, if we look at the Central African Republic in particular, then, a rather unlikely scenario I paint, but if there was some kind of Schneider-Plaut think tank was put together and allowed to take charge, I mean, is there anything that could be done in this specific instance, perhaps, even in the short term, that could mitigate against some of the worst excesses, some of these simply appalling mass killings that we're seeing? Any immediate short-term solutions that sort of jump to mind, or is it just simply an intractable problem?
No, I don't think problems are ever intractable. Eventually, I mean, after all, you think about it, France and Germany fought effectively three world wars between them, if you take the Anglo-Franco-Prussian War as being a world war. And today they have, you can walk across the border, nobody gives a damn where it is. So, you know, these things can be resolved. The difficulty is that the French, in a sense, have to make up their mind. Their major commitment is to Chad, and not to the Central African Republic. Yes, they're prepared to do something with the Central African Republic, but because of long-standing Gaullist relationships with the CAR, which go back to General de Gaulle's and the Chad's relationship with him during the Second World War, they have troops there, and that is their major concern. Now, Idriss Deby, the president of Chad, is frankly part of the problem, not the solution. And the Chadian troops in the Central African Republic were seen as extremely partial and on the side of the Muslims, the Seleka. So the difficulty with their intervention in the Central African Republic then destabilized the situation further. The French then coming is, people look at them and say, well, which side are you on? Now, there is the possibility of German troops, for the first time, being involved in this, which would be quite new. I don't think the Germans have, you know, seen dirt on their boots for, well, frankly, since the Second World War. It's probably not quite true, but I mean, something like that. So, you know, are they going to get involved? You might have another 500 European troops coming in to help. Might do something, but in the long run, it is really going to have to be solved by African leaders.
I think in the short term, European troops, non-French European troops, as much as France can de-Frenchify the military intervention, the better. And those can be deployed to particular hotspots, and they can sort of basically keep sides apart. But in the longer term, I mean, François Hollande really doesn't want to be, you know, France's intervention in Mali or this one in the Central African Republic, for it to be seen within the prism of La France-Afrique. But, you know, French neocolonialism. But unless strong French support is given to help build up an African independent security system, then France is going to feel called on to do these things and is going to be constantly accused of being neocolonial because of its very unpleasant neocolonial history.
Absolutely. Well, let's shift our sights a little further east. Sudan, mentioned at the top of the programme. The Sudanese government has ordered the suspension of the activities of the Red Cross in its country. The ICRC has operated for more than three decades. Sudan has expelled a number of aid organisations over the last 5 or 6 years or so. We talked a little there, Martin, about sort of military challenges. The humanitarian and aid projects are characterised by their own unique set of challenges too. In this instance, what do you think? We've got Sudan's own sort of humanitarian aid commission who says the ICRC doesn't measure up to its standards. Could they be right? Do they have a point? Or do you think, again, we're trapped in a sort of mire of political claim and counterclaim?
No, I mean, I would always believe the Red Cross in these instances. I mean, they're an excellent organisation with, you know, whatever it is, 100 years of history. They have a wonderful record. The difficulty with the Red Cross is they will almost never tell you what's really going on, because they have this unique relationship, even with repressive regimes, that they can go into prisons and intervene and talk to people, but they do everything off the record. But they are a remarkable organisation. And frankly, the Sudanese government has zero credibility. I mean, they have put out stories for years. I mean, they do have some issues on which they do have some claims, but I think on this one, I would certainly believe the Red Cross.
Yeah, I think that's true. The HAC, the government entity which you referred to, is not really an honest broker in how it deals with NGOs. I mean, you can understand why you might not want to have NGOs doing whatever they want in your country. There are arguments for that. But the way in which the HAC operates is basically hand in glove with the security services to basically check up on, frustrate, and make sure they're in control of any narrative and any humanitarian access. So really, when the Sudanese government is trying to frame this in terms of anything to do with humanitarian, it's really much, much more to do with not who do they not want to see what. And it's they don't want NGOs and international actors to see what is going on in their internal wars.
Do you think, Martin, just on this point, we've talked before about the media and challenges to journalism and journalists in terms of how they do their work and how the new media has changed a lot of these old assumptions about how people worked and the way that governments and journalists would engage and communicate with one another. Do you think NGOs are finding now that it's part of the shifting media landscape as much as anything else that's provoking these kind of challenges? Was their job of work easier, even, say, 2-3 decades ago than it is now?
Well, certainly then there wasn't the suspicion that they were leaking information to journalists. I think you're absolutely right on that. I mean, you know, I have some contacts, for example, in South Sudan. When the whole crisis erupted there, it was through, well, let me be honest, some of the NGOs that told me what was going on, and through their links into local people in the community tweeting and putting stuff on Facebook and knowing who to follow, because, you know, I just happen to know some of these people. And that is how I found out what was really going on. But I'm sure the governments don't like this. I mean, the Chinese government, of course, doesn't. It just blocks it all. But Africa hasn't got quite round to that yet. They don't.
Although Nigeria is trying.
Really?
I didn't know that. Martin, you mentioned South Sudan there. Just briefly, James, I mean, the UN too has fallen foul of some of this claim and counterclaim in South Sudan. People have accused them of stashing rebels and arms and this kind of thing. Do you think people are right to just be necessarily rather cynical about these kind of pronouncements? As Martin says, you know, it tends to often be the same actors making the same kind of claims.
Yeah, I mean, you have to view it in the context. And in this particular context, you've got President Salva Kiir, who thinks that anybody who isn't standing completely by his side alongside him, like the Ugandans are, is against him. And he wasn't being so anti the UN a month ago when this was all sort of starting. So it suggests that somebody said something to him, or somebody was saying, we've got some report of X, and that upset him, and now he's pushing back. I mean, yeah, again, the claims and counterclaims, they have to be seen in context, and they're generally speaking, if it's these sort of actors, not that credible.
Let's move on then to Rwanda. We were hearing actually in the news bulletin at the top of the programme about the start of the trial of Pascal Simbikangwa, a former intelligence chief of the country, of course, who's in a Paris court today on trial for complicity in genocide of around half a million ethnic Tutsis about 20 years ago. Two decades on, I guess that this trial is a reminder of the high stakes involved in the kinds of conflicts we're talking about, where in some cases, the aggressors are left to act with impunity. I just wondered about this particular trial, Martin. Someone like Pascal Simbakangwe, he's now been badly injured in a car accident. He's a paraplegic. He's a, in some quarters, claimed to be, he's more of a scapegoat. Do you have any sympathy with that position, or do you think he's one of these characters who it's quite right that he's on trial?
Well, I think it's absolutely right that he is on trial. I mean, what people like him did were absolutely appalling. And the extraordinary thing about the Rwandan genocide was that within a very short period of time, they were able to, you know, literally decimate, worse than decimate, you know, 800,000 people were murdered one by one, machete by machete. And, you know, it was an extraordinary act, which you know, it required extraordinary efficiency. And this was a highly, highly organized thing. Having said all that, I am always dubious about this kind of thing, because the difficulty is that it freezes the whole Rwandan narrative at one moment when the genocide happened. And you, in order to understand Rwanda, you have to see that this genocide was by far the worst, but by no means the only atrocity or even genocide. Some of them were perpetrated by Hutu. This was. Others were perpetrated by Tutsi. And that is the difficulty. And the Tutsi rulers of Rwanda, who are determined to hang on to power despite being only 15% of the population, they want to be in power forever. They want you to only look at that particular moment, and they do not want you to look further back in time. So I'm always slightly dubious about prosecuting these people when, frankly, there are also Tutsis who should be on trial as well, and they are protected.
It's a fair point, isn't it, James? There's two interesting points, I guess, there. Not only the fact that that difficulty of avoiding a freeze frame moment, which is a great challenge, but also the idea, I suppose, you know, of a character like this man. The charge is already reduced from genocide and crimes against humanity to complicity in them, which even in some respects, even although it's only a semantic point, perhaps already sounds like a sort of cop out of sorts. What's your view? Do you share Martin's concerns about some of the broader problems in terms of lacking a bit of what historical context?
Yeah, and that's going to be the case, I think, with any event that tries to work out exactly what happened in one particular moment. But I mean, going back to something else Martin said about the importance of accountability, I mean, I think, you know, even though that the post-genocide, you know, legal frameworks have broadly speaking, you know, not looked in any way the crimes of the RPA, that's the military wing of who are the now current rulers of Rwanda, the threat of accountability, the threat of bringing people to justice, I think, does have immediate effect on the ground. So going back to the Central African Republic, one of the things that Human Rights Watch have been doing there is gathering evidence of war crimes and then showing it to the commanders of either side, of the anti-Balak or the Seleka, and saying, look, we have this evidence. If you keep on doing this now, you are a war criminal. So this can prevent violence getting so much worse. And I think it is important to say, whilst obviously the situations in both the Central African Republic and South Sudan are terrible, they are many, many orders of magnitude less violent than what happened in Rwanda.
So just on that point, I mean, Martin, would it be wrong then to sort of try and make any kind of comparison, to try and suggest there are lessons, clear linear lessons to be learned from what we saw in the early to mid-1990s to what we're seeing today in CAR? Is that an unhelpful comparison then?
No. I think it is right, because I mean, and I very much agree with the point you make about accountability, because that is the thing that is now, in a sense, hanging over Africa. And one of the key institutions is the International Criminal Court. And in that context, it is tragic that the African summit, which happened this weekend, basically came out saying, oh, no, International Criminal Court must go away for any president. And you kind of think, well, hang on. This is precisely why you need an International Criminal Court, that everybody realizes from the highest to the lowest that in the end, somebody may come and get you. And that is why that has changed. And that is a real step forward. And it is tragic that African leaders are now, frankly, on the wrong side of history.
Those are the insights of Martin Plaut. James Schneider is alongside us as well. And we'll be hearing more from both of them when we come back in just a moment, when we'll talk about the role that someone from the ANC might be playing in trying to resolve the conflict in South Sudan. Stay tuned.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 25 minutes past the hour. Still with me are Martin Plaut of the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. We looked before the break at the struggles facing two Central African nations, the problems of providing military and humanitarian support. From Sudan, we head just south across the border to its southern neighbour. UN relief agencies in Juba estimate around 800,000 people have now been displaced, with over $1 billion needed in international aid to deal in the short term with the immediate crisis. Amidst all this, it's emerged that ANC Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa is attempting to mediate between the warring factions in the country. What perhaps can Ramaphosa achieve given so many other attempts at mediation in the region have failed? Martin, if I can start with you, it's quite interesting, this trip. It doesn't appear to be sanctioned by the sort of South African bodies perhaps that we often associate with these sorts of initiatives. Is someone trying to make a play here? Is this a personal glory mission for Ramaphosa? What do you make of it?
You know, I haven't the faintest idea why they've decided to send him. I mean, he's an extremely able and charming man. And, you know, I've spoken to him. He's very likable. And he has, you know, he's a businessman. He's made loads of money, got into a bit of trouble because he bought a wild buffalo for rather too much money. And you know, people thought he was going over the top and becoming a big capitalist. But, you know, he's a tremendously nice guy. But why they are asking him to do it? My guess is that they are a little unhappy about him showing up Zuma in the run up to the election because he comes over so well. And Jacob Zuma now is, frankly, such a tainted individual. Now, do you really want your number two to be looking squeaky clean when your number one is, shall we say, a little shop soiled?
Do you think it can be as simple as that, James? Sort of, you know, pack him off where he can't do any trouble and see if he can, even with his obvious charms, can he bring them to bear on such a complex situation as South Sudan?
I mean, it could be that. It could also be that, you know, they've already got some kind of ceasefire agreement. It's not totally holding, but there was already negotiations going on, mediated by other people. And if he's there, then he can sort of put another feather in his cap and say that he was involved in, you know, in something positive in South Sudan, and that helps his bid to become president after Zuma in 2019. But I mean, as Martin said, we don't really know why. It's not like there was an official Department of International Relations statement saying, right now we're sending him out because he's going to do this thing. So it seems a little bit weird.
Knowing him as you do, Martin, maybe he just decided off his own back to do it.
Oh, no. That's
draw a line somewhere.
You don't get the blessing. But I mean, you know, he is a remarkably clever man. I mean, for example, when he was the person who brokered the relationship with Rolf Meyer that led to the constitution of South Africa. I mean, when at the end of apartheid. And the key relationship, I was told, was over fishing. They went trout fishing, and apparently he's pretty good. And they sort of bonded over the trout.
So many strings to his bow, this man. Well, let's talk very briefly about a bit of domestic South African politics then to close. Intriguing stories about the Democratic Alliance Party accusing Ramaphosa of reneging on a deal to join the party before this year's elections. A lot of excitement at this potentially historic pact. We could have had the first black female presidential candidate and, well, potentially, I suppose, a political force robust enough to sort of end the ANC domination. James, do you think that was a practical ambition, a practical aim,
no,
a likely ideal? Absolutely not.
No, the whole thing, I think, in the first place was really overhyped. And now everyone, not to say that if it hadn't worked, it wouldn't have been a mildly positive thing in the development of opposition politics within South Africa. But it was hyped up as this the line that the DA came out with was that it was a game changer for South African politics. And that line kind of got replicated in the media, and people were sort of saying, well, yes, it really could be. And when you look at the figures, when you look, you know, the massive difference between the ANC support and the DA support, and also what kind of support that Ramphele could bring, how much would that be? It was overstated. But now it doesn't look very good for her. It doesn't look very good for her for the same reasons why her coming in as the presidential candidate wouldn't have been a game changer. Because she entered politics about a year ago, and there was a lots of positive feeling towards her. She got very good coverage when she first came in. Basically, the last year has been a bit of a failure. There's, you know, failed to gain sufficient financial support from backers, failed to get enough sort of polling support, failed to really engage with the South African people about what her party would do as opposed to what her criticisms of the ANC are, which are very, very cogent and lots of people agree with them. And so it's that same kind of narrative which has played out in this very quick and messy divorce.
Martin, just on that point then, any chance of a seismic shift then in terms of the political balance in South Africa? Or do you think the ANC, I guess particularly sort of after the death of Mandela, there seemed to be a lot of nostalgia and sort of positive views back towards the ANC. It seemed to almost help them out of some of their poll holes they were in. Any prospect of change to that, do you think?
No. I mean, I think that the problem for the ANC was revealed when Jacob Zuma spoke at the funeral and he was booed. By the ANC supporters. I mean, that was just catastrophic for him. I mean, this has been a huge blunder.
And it was Cyril Ramaphosa who had to then go and speak to them and say, guys, come on, calm down. This is embarrassing. We've got guests.
But this is catastrophic for the Democratic Alliance. I mean, the reason that they went for it was that the polling that the Democratic Alliance had showed that there were a lot of black people who thought that the Democratic Alliance wanted to bring back apartheid. Now, the DA has a long history of fighting apartheid. So, I mean, it was completely wrong, but people had this image of them. And by putting a black woman as their presidential candidate, it would clearly erode that position. But the other thing is that there is a strand within the Democratic Alliance which says, look, we should never have gone down this road. We should put people up on their ability and forget about their the skin colour. The trouble is that South African history is so troubled on the race issue that is not really viable. And I think that was what Helen Zille was trying to do, to leapfrog the issue of race and say, look at us as people. But having a black woman there made a huge difference.
That's Martin Plaut. We also heard from James Schneider. Gentlemen, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there today. Thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House today.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
So plenty more still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. So we'll catch up on the news coming out of Italy with our correspondent Ivan Carvalho. We'll also check out the Stockholm Furniture Fair. Lots of glass and brass apparently dominating the agenda there. And we'll review some music coming out of New York City. Before we get started on all of that, though, and with the time at 33 minutes past the hour here in London, let's hear from Paul Osborne, who's here with the latest world news headlines.
The Taliban in Pakistan has criticised the country's government after preliminary negotiations between the two were postponed. It said the government wasn't serious about peace talks. Officials said they wanted further clarification of exactly who they would be meeting. Britain says its military did offer advice to India before an attack on a Sikh temple 30 years ago, in which up to 3,000 people died. A review was ordered after the claims first emerged last month of possible British links with the Amritsar massacre of 1984, but Britain's Foreign Secretary says the advice had only a limited impact. A former Rwandan intelligence chief has gone on trial in Paris, accused of complicity in the genocide in the country 20 years ago. It's alleged Pascal Simbakangwa helped to arm ethnic Hutu militias, then encouraged them to kill Tutsis. Opposition MPs have told Ukraine's parliament that there must be changes to the country's constitution. They want the power of the president to be reduced as pressure continues on Viktor Yanukovych to respond to weeks of anti-government demonstrations. One opposition leader says the president is dragging his feet. And Thailand's main opposition parties launched a legal challenge to try to annul the results of the election on Sunday. The Democratic Party says the ballot was a violation of the Thai constitution, as voting didn't take place in 9 provinces. But the government says the opposition's blockades of polling stations were the cause of the problem. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. And Paul Osborne will be back with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the next hour. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. And it is to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We go next. We're heading to Milan. Our man there, Ivan Carvalho, is standing by. Ivan, thank you for joining us. Great to speak to you, as always. And I gather we're starting, well, with, in the beauty of Milan, some rather ugly scenes, aren't there, in the Parliament. Tell us exactly what's been going on.
Yeah, good evening, Tom. This past week has seen quite a lot of activity in the Parliament in Rome. Some ugly scenes, though. There's been some scuffles and confrontations by various parliamentarians of the Five Star Movement, Beppe Grillo's party, objecting to some of the handling of the passage of bills by the House Speaker, Laura Baldrini, and it sort of just descended into a bit of chaos. There were some fist flying and lots of very raw insults being hurled at members of the Democratic Party, and quite an ugly scene.
Absolutely. Now tell us, I mean, Beppe Grillo's Five Star Movement has sort of, you know, won a lot of plaudits initially. They've sort of had to wake up to the realities of life in office and involvement in politics. It's been rather more difficult. But I guess other parties are not going to be that happy with Five Star and some of these tactics. Exactly how much criticism have they come in for?
Well, they've gotten criticism on all fronts. If you look at the political spectrum. Of course, they argue that it was unprecedented, the move by the House Speaker, Laura Baldrini. She cut off a debate using a power that had never been used before in post-wartime politics. It's called the guillotine. To cut short a debate, the Five Star Movement was trying to do a filibuster on a passage of a property tax and also a recapitalization of the Bank of Italy, which would have helped commercial banks. And that's where the Five Star Movement were upset. But the tactics that were used, some of these online campaigns against the House Speaker, accusations of that she should be assaulted or even raped, are things that from Prime Minister Letta down the line, people are saying this is squalid and this should remain outside of Parliament.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you mentioned Prime Minister Enrico Letta there. Plenty on the plate, lots in the in-tray, including some deals to do with Italy and its relationships with the sort of across the Gulf region. Tell us what's been agreed.
Yeah, the Persian Gulf seems to be in the eye of sight of Letta and the Italian economy and companies. I was there recently in Dubai, where the Italian Navy was promoting the defense industry with the tour of its aircraft carrier. And Letta has been in the region, Kuwait, Doha, and Qatar. And he's just secured more funds from, of course, the sovereign wealth funds. Kuwait's putting up $500 million. The Qatar investment fund has put through several billion in the last year, investments in luxury hotels. And we may even see now there are talks going on as we speak between Alitalia, the Sterling airline, and Etihad of Abu Dhabi to come in and rescue Alitalia, which is in dire straits.
Absolutely. And as you say, Ivan, worth pointing out that people will be able to read some more of your sort of insights from that trip in our March issue, which will be out, of course, on newsstands, well, in the next kind of week or two, which they must track down, of course. Let's talk a little bit about statistics. Always compelling, I think, Ivan. What's the National Statistics Agency been up to?
Well, ISTAT, the Italian agency that you mentioned, they keep track of all kinds of figures, unemployment, inflation, and when they look at the national basket of goods, when they're calculating inflation, and they're looking at what Italians are buying, you know, the popular goods, but you know, the goods have changed over the decades from what people used to buy. So now you see in their latest measurement, you see things like electronic cigarettes and even coffee capsules. So before, when every Italian household, even mine included, had the stovetop coffee maker, now you see people using these Nespresso-style machines. Online newspaper subscriptions are now factored in. So they've taken into account that there have been, progress has been made. And so these goods need to go into the basket to calculate prices.
Absolutely. Always intriguing watching those baskets around the world. Just a final note on that, Ivan. You mentioned the rise of these sort of Nespresso-type pods. Surely we're not going to see the end of the classic stovetop espressos, are we? You're not going to abandon yours, are you?
No, I personally use still the what's called the mocha, which you can, I'm pretty sure you can find in every household in Italy. I think that will resist this temptation to go for the ease of these pop capsules, which everybody, you see now in offices. But I don't think there's going to be a rush to abandon the mocha. I think it's still well loved by millions of Italians.
Good stuff. Good to know that's here to stay. Ivan, many thanks for joining us here on the programme. That was Ivan Carvalho, our Milan correspondent. Up next on the programme, we'll pay a visit to Stockholm to talk furniture at this year's Design Fair. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now, the Stockholm Furniture and Light Fair got started today, touted as the world's biggest meeting place for lovers of Scandinavian design, and there are many. Rubbing shoulders with exhibitors and designers alike, this week the media, and eventually the lucky public, are all congregating at the Stockholm Messen to see the upcoming trends in furniture and lighting design. Johanna Agerman-Ross, curator of the 12 exhibition and editor-in-chief of Disegno magazine, told me what you could find at this year's offering.
12th is a new initiative by the Stockholm Furniture and Light Fair, which is aiming to create a platform for more established designers to show their work. It's interesting because before you've had places like Greenhouse, which still exists within the fair, where young designers that are recently graduated can show their work. But there hasn't been this space for established talent to actually show products that aren't necessarily in production or where they're just showing their ideas and kind of thoughts around design. So 12 is really aimed at people that already have things in production with the furniture manufacturers and other companies to show the work that they are wanting to produce and things that haven't yet found a home in terms of becoming a real product.
Absolutely. And Johanna, tell me a bit more about the process involved then, because I know that one of the exhibitors in the space is TAF Architecture, which is actually the designers of the space. Did you have to work quite closely together? Was it a collaborative thing, or were you able to curate the space they designed and you both sort of worked fairly independently? How did that process work?
Well, yeah, in fact, my role as curator is it's not quite a curatorship as you would see, for example, curating an exhibition in a museum. There's no overall theme or concept to the show. I really acted more as someone who selected the participants and looking at their work and seeing how they would fit side by side, both looking at where they're from, what their age is, but also what their aesthetic and style is of their work, and seeing that it actually matches one another without looking too similar, but also not being so disparately different that it doesn't sort of sit well within one context. I mean, TAF or TAF, they have been very kind of passionate in leading this project on. They really wanted to have this space for more established designers to show within the fair. And they created and designed the platform, the exhibition space for them to show in. I mean, I had an idea of what the space would look like before we started. And as a result, I knew that there was kind of no walls, that it would be a very open exhibition display. So obviously I had to take into consideration that things would really sit side by side. Can I continue, Tom, or should
No, absolutely. Please go ahead.
Yeah. So the process itself meant there were close to 30 applicants. It was an open call that went out quite late at the end of October to designers within Scandinavia. And then I got to go through their portfolios and concepts for what they wanted to show. And then from that, make the selection on, you know, who I think should be part of the final exhibition. So that's what happened. And it was fairly kind of easy in terms of, you know, I think there's some really strong candidates, you know, such as Harry Koskinen or Peter Opsvik, who are very, very established names. Peter Opsvik is a industrial designer from Norway that's worked for many years. He's very well known for his very comfortable and ergonomically correct seating for offices. And Harry Koskinen, of course, is the creative director of Itala. So it was really interesting that these people found this space interesting to participate in.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's fascinating, Johanna. I just wonder, in terms of how then 12 fits into the overall, it's obviously such a busy time, you know, in the city, so much happening, such a focus of all of these different design minds. How do you feel that 12 fits then into that overall picture? Do you think it will certainly be something that really captures people's imagination, even with all of this other competing interests on offer?
Well, I think what's nice about it is that normally you'd find a display like 12 inside the Stockholm City Centre as an independent exhibition by the different designers. This hasn't really existed within the fair itself before. So what's nice about that is that people that are going to the fair more kind of with a business mind also have this possibility of seeing this work, which isn't necessarily always... you know, doesn't always end up as a sort of final product for the manufacturer. And I think that that's what's interesting. It reaches a new audience that otherwise would necessarily go and see these exhibitions within the Stockholm City Centre. So it's just a new concept, a context for these designers to show in such close proximity to the furniture manufacturers that they either already work with or would like to work with. And I think that's a great opportunity. I mean, in the big scheme of things, it's a fairly small space within the big fair. And of course, even smaller space, if you look at everything in offer in Stockholm this week. But nevertheless, I think a very important one, a very important step in the right direction to show this type of work. And I think it will only grow in the coming years at the fair.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to ask you more broadly, Johanna, and in terms of this sort of ongoing, I guess it's almost an obsession people have, certainly here at Monocle. You know, we love the whole idea of, you know, Nordic design. There's so many. You mentioned Harry Koskinen and Peter Opsvik, great names that we already sort of are familiar with and know and like. What is it about the sensibilities, do you think, of the kind of Nordic design movement as a whole that make it have such an enduring appeal? Because wherever you go in the world, you see the influence, you see what passions it fires in people. Is it something about the simplicity of the design, the clarity of vision? What is it that means it has such an enduring appeal?
Well, I think what you mentioned there, clarity of vision and sort of the minimal design, is certainly a very important one, because I think it means it fits into many different contexts. It's very flexible at the same time. And, you know, you can add in a piece of Scandinavian design and something much more opulent, and it still kind of works. So, you know, I think that with kind of the great pieces of modernism, that's always the case. I think that there's a truth to material, which I think is very appealing to people. You know, there's often kind of, you know, the wood is on display, or you really see what things are made of, and that creates a kind of tactility and a nice kind of connection with the object, the product or piece of furniture that you're sitting in or, you know, touching and so on. And I think that that's something that's really, really important. And I think the style is kind of timeless. And I guess in a way where we kind of look to maybe not spend money on kind of new furnishings all the time, it's something that often kind of looks graceful and very good with age. And I think that a lot of the things that you saw or that I saw in the fair today have that timeless appeal. And that's, of course, you know, something that is very attractive to if you want to furnish your office or, you know, a hotel lobby or something like that, where, you know, you don't necessarily want to switch and change all the time, but actually have something that, that is longer lasting. And I think Scandinavian design, if you are to generalize, has that long lasting appeal.
It does indeed. And that's Johanna Agerman, the Ross Curator of the 12 exhibition at this year's Stockholm Messen. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're ticking towards the top of the hour, which means the end of the programme. Before we go, though, time for our daily review segment. Today, we're talking music. New York label Luwaka Bop specialises in what they like to call unclassifiable pop. Unsurprising, perhaps, as it was founded by, the genius that is David Byrne of Talking Heads in 1988, who took its name from the inside packaging of specialty tea drank here in England. I'm delighted to say we're joined from our New York bureau by the president of the Luwaka Bop label, Yale Everlev, to run through some of their own new releases and a bit more music besides. Welcome to the show, Yale. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to hear from you. Where should we start? What about what's the first song you got? Ride the Tiger, I believe, is the top of your list. Tell us about that one.
It's performed by a man named Doug Cream Blunt, and I heard a track of his on a mixtape that someone made, and I tracked him down. He had put out a self-released record a few years ago and dropped it off, and asked a record store in San Francisco if they would carry it, and they said sure. And then they didn't listen to it until a week or so later, and then they listened to it and said, wow, this is great, and he put no contact information on it, so he would kind of disappeared for about a year before he showed back up to see if they had sold any. So, it's for us, as I've said, as you said, we try to work with things that aren't that classifiable. And I think this is pretty much something that when people ask me what kind of music is it, I kind of scratch my head and I say, well, you know, it's kind of soul music, but soul music in a very San Francisco way. I mean, there's the band is all women pretty much. And he's another person who, unlike the William Onyebar record we did a few months ago, he will talk at all you like about himself, but he doesn't say very much. So you get like a little few sentences. I said, well, this band that I see, it's all women. Was that the band on the record? He goes, yes, that was the band. I goes, did you guys play a lot of gigs? No, we didn't. I said, well, then I figured he had another career, right? If he wasn't playing music, then he probably would. So I said, what did you do to make money? He goes, well, I was a musician. I was like, oh, okay, so where did you play? And did you play in clubs? Were you like in the jazz scene? He goes, no, we used to play in like old age homes and hospitals and places like that. And I said, very confusing, like, the more information he gave you, the more confused it got, really.
Absolutely. So, well, he sounds like a great character, Yale, and you said he's a man of few words, so perhaps we should let his music speak for itself. Let's take a quick listen to this one. This is Ride the Tiger, which is coming out this summer. Let's take a listen. I'm not sure what the old folks in the old folks' homes will have made of that one, Yale, but that's Doug Cream Blunt. Did they go for that one as well, do you think?
Well, he didn't play his music in the old folks' home. He played covers of some kind.
Oh, you see.
And the man
knows his audience, at least.
Every track has some kind of strange guitar solo on it. And you listen to the guitar solos and you go, what are you thinking about when you're playing that? And I said, I finally got a chance to say, so what, your guitar style, where did that come from? He goes, well, at 17, I saw Jimi Hendrix. And I was like, oh, okay. It doesn't sound anything like Jimi Hendrix, but
That's where he's got his inspiration from. Now, you mentioned William Onyebo in passing there. Let's listen to some one of his tracks. So you've got a couple that you picked out. Maybe tell me a little bit about Love Me Now. Tell me about this one.
Well, I picked that one because it's on the vinyl edition and not on the CD. And I thought, well, if people had the digital download or the CD and they don't have the vinyl, then they might not be as familiar with that. But it's kind of more of a disco-y track that he did, and it's pretty cool. We're going to be doing a concert of this music at the Barbican in April 1st. So I'm really looking forward to how this will kind of evolve into a live thing.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure the London audience is going to be very receptive. Let's give our listeners, certainly on this side of the pond, a little bit of a sneak preview. Here's a bit of Love Me Now from William Onyebo. So that's William Onyebo, Love Me Now, the LP only track from one of your recent compilations. Like the sound of that one. Yeah, now tell me, I don't want to just do loads of free PR for Luwaka Bob, as fun as it is. Why don't you tell us a little bit, what else has caught your ears recently? You've got Andrew Ashong, I believe. Tell us about this.
Well, he's not, I get the impression that in England he's getting a real reputation, but in the States he hasn't really. He hasn't caught on that much yet, and I just thought he's doing something really emotional, seemingly kind of simple, and yet it has a tremendous power. And it's so that it's kind of what I always am looking for in music, something that really, you want to keep listening to. You want to listen to over and over again. It really makes you feel something, and he does it in such a different way. I've also been really interested in lately how people are using kind of sonic space, where they put different instruments in their voice in different places in a way that could be considered wrong to some extent, but it sounds very right.
Great. Well, that sounds amazing. Let's take a listen. What should we play? Maybe Special? Does that meet your approval?
Sure,
that's
great.
Let's take a listen to this one. This is Special from Andrew Ashong. I was just speculating as to what Andrew Ashong was up to when he came up with that one. I don't know what I'm thinking. Tell me what is it about Andrew Ashong? Why so much? I know you sort of alluded to some of the qualities there. What is it about that song in particular that you like?
Well, I mean, listen to where the drums and the bass are. There's a totally different place than where the voice is, and then there's this kind of a string pad that goes on. It's again in a totally different place, and they're all in different rooms in a way. And he's not really saying anything. It's all pretty much on one chord, and yet there's a tremendous amount of emotion contained in it. And I just think it's very beautiful.
Great stuff. We're almost out of time here, I'm sorry to say. But just tell me, as we're keeping an eye on what Luwaka Bob are up to then throughout 2014, what are you sort of most excited about? We've heard a couple of your artists, pretty exciting records coming out. What are you most exciting for in the next sort of 12 months?
Well, you know, we are doing a remix record with a lot of the Onyebo stuff. Hot Chip did an amazing version of Atomic Bomb, and that's just fantastic. We can't wait to put that out. And we have a Brazilian singer named Moreno Veloso, whose father is Caetano Veloso, and he's got a new record coming this spring it's really, really cool.
Terrific stuff. Yael Evalev, president of Luwaka Bob, a music label in New York, thanks so much for coming into our New York bureau to catch up with us today on the program. And that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Special thanks to Martin Plaut and James Schneider here in the studio, who talked us through the difficulties facing international relief efforts in Central Africa. Today's show was produced by Alla John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Bullock, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next up after the headlines is Section D. Amongst other topics up for discussion will be a report for Monocle's Gillian de Bias in Cape Town about the World Design Capital. This show returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.